Let us turn to the book of Job tonight. Chapter 2. And we'll read beginning with verse 7 from chapter 2. And I'd like to read all the way till the end of chapter 3. So went Satan forth from the presence of the Lord, and smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself withal, and he sat down among the ashes. Then said his wife unto him, Dost thou still retain thy integrity? Curse God and die. But he said unto her, Thou speakest as one of the foolish women speaketh. What shall we receive good at the hand of God, and shall we not receive evil? In all this did not Job sin with his lips. Now when Job's three friends heard of all this evil that was come upon him, they came every one from his own place. Eliphaz the Temanite, and Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite, for they had made an appointment together to come to mourn with him and to comfort him. And when they lifted up their eyes afar off and knew him not, they lifted up their voice and wept, and they rent every one his mantle and sprinkled dust upon their heads toward heaven. So they sat down with him upon the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and none spake a word unto him, for they saw that his grief was very great. After this opened Job his mouth, and he cursed his day. And Job spake and said, Let the day perish wherein I was born, and the night in which it was said, There is a man-child conceived. Let that day be darkness. Let not God regard it from above, neither let the light shine upon it. Let darkness and the shadow of death stain it. Let a cloud dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. As for that night, let darkness seize upon it. Let it not be joined unto the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Lo, let that night be solitary. Let no joyful voice come therein. Let them curse it that curse the day, who are ready to raise up their mourning. Let the stars of the twilight thereof be dark. Let it look for light, but have none. Neither let it see the dawning of the day. Because it shut not up the doors of my mother's womb, nor bid sorrow from mine eyes. Why died I not from the womb? Why did I not give up the ghost when I came out of the belly? Why did the knees prevent me? Or why the breast that I should suck? For now should I have lain still and been quiet, I should have slept. Then had I been at rest. With kings and councils of the earth, which built desolate places for themselves. Or with princes that had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or as an unhidden, untimely birth had I not been, as infants which never saw light. There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary be at rest. There the prisoners rest together. They hear not the voice of the oppressor. The small and great are there, and the servant is free from his master. Wherefore is light given to him that is in misery, and life unto the bitter in soul? Which long for death, but it cometh not, and dig for it more than for hid treasures. Which rejoice exceedingly, and are glad, when they can find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hid, and whom God has hedged in? For my sighing cometh before I eat, and my roaring are poured out like the waters. For the thing which I greatly feared is come upon me, and that which I was afraid of is come unto me. I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came. Now, so far, Job's thoughts. Let us seek the Lord together. Faithful, almighty and all-knowing God, we thank Thee for the word that Thou hast given us, in which Thou gives us also a true reflection of what is to be and not to be, of what is good and not good. And as we, Lord, this evening look at a subject that touched the life of Job so intense and so deep, then we may still learn also from his book, and we may learn tonight together. And we pray that also this evening then may be a useful preparation to prepare us to walk with those in an effective way whom Thou art leading to the valleys of the shadows of death, or the valleys of affliction and trial. And Lord, there are many around us who journey such journeys, sometimes so unnoticed to us, or unnoticeable perhaps, but nonetheless real, daily, felt. And we pray, dear God, that also this evening may equip us a little bit more to help those whom Thou art placing upon our pathway, who travel through the journeys of grief and pain, the journeys of struggling and wrestling with thoughts within, as Job we read of this evening. And Lord, perhaps it will be our own journey that we in some ways will again relive or see in different ways. And so be pleased to bless us this evening with that grace which also eventually Thou gave to Job, to quiet his heart and to give him rest in a submission to Thy sovereignty in his life. The Lord, Thou knows best. Thou knows so infinitely better than what we do know, what we need or don't need. And so teach us, O God, to wait upon Thee, as the poet that we sang of, "What wait I for, but on Thee, O Lord." And so bless us together. May this evening, if all those who are listening also at home or abroad, be blessed also through what we may learn tonight. So hear our prayer, Lord, be with all those that plan to be here and couldn't make it. Lord, I remember the needs of those who have great issues to face today, great needs to face, or gladness. Lord, Thou give what is necessary so that we may follow Thee. Hear us then, O faithful Lord, in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. I review. Can we distribute those? Now, it's been a while. Sorry for that. Seems like life is sometimes too busy. Too many evenings are busy and gone, so. Well, it's been about a month and a half, I think, we had our last meeting on this. So tonight, what I want to finish it up, and we have looked in two sessions at grief itself, at what it is, what it feels like somehow, how children experience it. I remind you of my beautiful triangle. Life as we are having it most of the day, everything goes well, and all of a sudden something big happens in our life, tragic, something we know, and life feels like this. And obviously we're very tippy. Now, in between the last time and this time, I mean, I experienced accepting a call. And I did not realize, and I think I mentioned it the last time, that grief, of course, does not only happen when you lose a loved one to death. You know, grief happens in every kind of situation where loss is experienced. Loss of health, loss of a job, loss of retirement. Now, I felt intense grief when I accepted this call. I didn't realize I would feel this. And I've gone through a lot of the same emotions that I have gone through, surprisingly to me. I was not expecting this. It took me at least a month or more to get myself a little bit more in the perspective of reinvestment. That's obviously what finally a grieving person does when he has gone through all the variety of losses that trickle in. Primary loss, and then all the secondary losses. And finally, as he's gone through that whole journey, he comes to the stage of reinvestment. I remember what the whole thing about grief was. It was adjustment, right? It's an adjustment of a new reality. Yeah, and I all of a sudden have to now adjust to a totally new reality in my family, in my personal life, leaving you behind, facing a whole new future with who knows what. So I really felt like this. I really felt very unstable and obviously didn't last as long. And I feel right now I'm probably kind of here again. And what's interesting now, I begin now to get the reinvestment feelings again. Okay, now, okay, the Lord is closing this part of my life, and now another part of my life is coming, and you begin to think, now what's God wanting me to do there? And so then, as a grief journey, you go back up again out of the valley. So, to me, it was really an educational experience that grief can be so intense, even though you don't have a death. But in a certain sense, I did have a death. Because letting go of something really, really special, which you are and this place, is like a little dying. That's over. It's come back. Yeah? So let's recognize it from one another. Second thing I want to share is I got a lot of emails from these two topics, not only from here, but from abroad as well, in which people told me, you know, I never recognized I was a griever. Really interesting, people who did not go through losses like I've gone through with death involved, but have other losses, and mentioned, you know what, a lot of these emotions that you put out there, I'm going through right now, even though I don't have necessarily a death case in my family. So let's be alerted to it. Let's look around us and see people who all of a sudden face big changes. There may not be a funeral. There may not be a big public display of emotion. Yet grief can be very real. So those are the two things I want to just share as a reflection on the last time that we get together. Now, tonight, I just have collected a few directions how to be the most effective helper. Yeah. Now this really is the first aid course in the conclusion. Yeah, how can I now help a person who is grieving? Yeah, you're not the griever now. Yeah, you're the one who stands around the person. And you know there's someone in your pew, there's someone in your neighborhood, there's someone at your work, someone in your family who's going through the grief. How now do I handle that person? Most of us feel very uncomfortable facing a person that goes through grief. Right? And most of it is because I don't know what to say. Now, interesting what I read tonight. What did you notice tonight, what I read from Job? He said nothing? They said nothing. 7 days, they said, 7 days long, they said nothing. Can you imagine that? Sitting there 7 days with this Job, and absolutely no conversation goes on. Now, is there no conversation going on? Big conversation going on. But it's silent. It's going on in Job. And all of a sudden, Job burst out in chapter 3. And what does Job say in chapter 3? Okay or not okay? It's not okay at all, is it? This is not one of the chapters that we think it's okay to say these kind of things. Curse the death of my birthday, and wish it never happened. I wish I had a miscarriage, my mom, a miscarriage, and that thing's not right. So what's happening in the 7 days? In those 7 days that nobody's talking, Job is talking. And he is talking. And man, is he talking. Inside.
And all of a sudden, it's like the plug cuts loose and there he goes. And of course, those friends, are they shocked or not shocked? They're shocked. This is a godly man. They are utterly shocked. Wow, Job, do you dare to say these things? And they begin to react, obviously also very shockingly. Because they're going to say, "Oh, Job, we're going to correct you right now." And you go read to those next chapters and those men are giving Job all kinds of advice or correction that only, what does it do to Job? It only makes him more angry. It only stirs the fire more. And he begins to say things that are probably even more inappropriate. Even though through it you notice his struggle, complete struggle of faith, of believing and surrendering, but he's also a fallen creature. And a lot of what comes out of Job, friends, sad to say, was stirred up by his so-called helpers. And so I think Job's book has been given to us as a tremendous counseling book as well. How do you now deal with a person like Job? Yeah, that is a hard one. I can see that you sit down for 7 days with this man and say nothing. But then what we learned from the rest of the book. So those are some of the things that are reflected this evening in the subject I have with you. How do you be the most effective helper? So I'll share these things with you with hopefully examples of what I myself have experienced. And at this moment, obviously also try to practice. Now, the first thing is a quote of Albert Camus. "Don't walk in front of me. I may not follow. Don't walk behind me. I may not lead. But walk beside me and just be my friend. Just be my friend." Now, we all can understand that statement, but how can you now just be friend? What does it now mean to a grieving person to be a friend to him or to her or to them? Well, my first definition of a friend is a sacrificial friend is a friend who empties himself to serve others. That's a big statement. A friend is someone who goes out of himself, gives up whatever comforts he may have to give up in order to be there for the person who he tries to minister to. That's going to cost you something. If you're going to be a real friend, it's going to have to cost you something. Yeah, otherwise it's not a friend. Then it's an acquaintance or whatever it is. A real friend, when you sacrifice. I do not believe that most people in this world need a counselor. Most people that are going through a crisis don't need a counselor. They need a friend. The reason that counseling is spiking today, and it is in our communities, is I think because people are not friends anymore, or understanding friends, or sacrificial friends, committed friends. There's a lot of loneliness in our society. And if I listen to the counselors, and know a few of them, basically what counselors do to people who come, they listen. And if it's a good counselor, they probably do most of that, 95%, they just listen. And you pay money for that. As you talk. Now, of course, there's some real critical cases. There are some cases that definitely professional counseling. But I argue that most people that go to counseling rooms today don't necessarily need a professional counselor. They need a skillful friend who is willing to listen and help them to go through the emotions. Not like Job's friends. Yeah, Job wanted to talk. Remember? He wanted to talk. And what he's boiling up in chapter 3 is not nice. And he wants to have it come out because he's been talking himself for 7 days. And finally he blurts it out. He needed somebody to talk to. And not someone to respond to him. So, don't take me wrong here. I do not at all think that we need to downplay counselors, but I wonder whether there is just a complete desert of real friends today. I was emailing this week with a young person from the Netherlands who has gone through a whole story, But one of the reasons that I asked is, well, why can you not trust someone in your area to talk to? Why do you have to talk to me? And she says, I can't trust people because there's not a whole lot of people that are listening and listening with keeping the things that I talked with them about to themselves. Yeah? And that's really awful. You got a young person who says, I don't dare to talk to people because when I talk to people, I can hear via later on that they've talked about what I said. So a real friend is a sacrificial saint who listens and is done confidentiality, right? If someone shares something with you, you've got to indeed keep it confident between you and him or her so that they will feel free to empty out more into your ear. So, cards, phone calls, today of course we're in texting and creative gifts. One person very beautifully said she was going through a grieving period and she didn't feel like picking up the telephone, so she had the answering machine on, and so her friend called and says, you know what, I just want to let you know I'm thinking of you and I'm actually going to play this psalter for you. And she played a psalter on the piano. He says, that was so meaningful. Just to give a little feeling of, I'm there as your friend, and I know you want your space, but I just want to let you know, I'm also there as your friend. Now, when you in your friendship relationship see that your friend is not getting better and is only going downhill, obviously, professional help is needed. And that's when you need to help them. I come back there in the end. Now, B. Create the safety to speak about the event and to express feelings that are very uncomfortable to speak about. There's a lot of subjects that are taboo, and one of them is death. Those of you who are married, how many of you have talked about your death with your spouse? Say, oh, I'm so young yet. There's no guarantee you're going to have a long life together. How many of you have talked about your death? Well, we don't talk about that. Because it's taboo. We don't feel like talking about that. And of course you don't have to talk about it all the time. But it is a subject that we usually try to avoid till all of a sudden it needs to be. We need to stop the conspiracy of silence about death. Because if we are not speaking about it, we are not preparing ourselves for the reality. But it's not only prior to an event that people are reluctant to talk about death. It's also after the event that people are reluctant to talk about. Death is really a taboo subject. And yet, if I have lost my wife, I'm thinking about her death, certainly in those first months, probably 24 hours a day. It's in me, it's talking in me, and I want to be able to talk about it. But how do I dare to talk about a subject nobody wants to talk about? If you don't give me the cue, I won't talk about it. So you as the friend, right, you're not going through the loss, you've not had the loss, but I've had the loss. I'm waiting to hear it safe to talk about the subject. And that's your task. I knew, and in these first weeks or months, whatever it was, when people called me that hadn't really spoken to me for quite a while about with me, I acutely could feel I was listening to them. Okay, are they really actually wanting to listen to me or not? Are they going to say anything about Melanie? Are they going to say anything about that? And most people didn't. They avoided the subject. And then I avoid it too. Yeah. But there are others who say, hey, how are you doing? It must be very quiet. It must be very difficult at night. Some of people knew what was going on. They gave you the safety to talk. So please do not feel like, sometimes people say, yeah, but if I bring it up, that's hurtful. Right? I don't want to stir up the hurtful feelings. Well, I think what I say,
Believers feel embarrassed about their own thoughts and hesitate to share them for fear of rejection and judgment. So you need to keep in mind that the griever actually is feeling afraid to share with you and therefore needs to know from you, it's okay to share my thoughts. Yeah? So the next time you meet someone, I met someone years ago who lost in a tragic accident, lost her daughter. And I remember seeing her in the shop. Obviously not the best place to have a talk, but I did. And I said to her, so-and-so, how are you doing? She's doing, I'm fine. I says, you cannot be doing fine, because I know you're thinking about so-and-so probably all day long. Now, that was all I needed to say, and I stood there for an hour. Yeah, she was testing the water. I'm doing fine. Now, if I said, okay, I'm doing fine, well, I hope you have a good day, opportunity lost. This is a person who's gone through a loss, but she feels, I want to shelter myself because I'm not sure this guy wants to listen to me. Yeah? I broke the ice by saying, it can't be quite fine if you have gone through a loss like this. And that was all she needed. And then, bang. Now, be prepared to be a friend, a sacrificial, right? I wasn't planning on an hour. And sometimes you don't have that time. You have to be honest. And you have to say, okay, listen, I don't have the time right now, but I'm going to call you tonight. Okay? But that's a sacrificial friend. You need to sometimes give up. So create the safety of talking. You've all heard the story of the white elephant? No, not too many people have heard about the white elephant. But everybody knows the story when I talk about it. Story is like, it's actually a kid's book. It's a really awesome book. I don't know where to find it now, but it's a kid's book in which you see a family sitting together in the living room, and in the middle of the living room stands a big, life-size white elephant. So just, you know, think of a big living room and sends a white elephant in there. Or a black elephant, whatever color you want. And so, dad, mom, brothers, sisters, and so on are sitting in a circle trying to have a conversation. But every time they try to talk across the living room, that stupid elephant moves his big paw in between, so you can't see each other. And then, you move this way, and then the big elephant moves again. So every time you turn a page, this big elephant is standing in between this whole group of people, stopping the conversation. And finally, Johnny gets so upset about the fact he's going upstairs to his bedroom. He says, I'm going to go sit in my bedroom. And dad goes outside in the yard, and mom goes out in the kitchen, blah, blah, blah. So finally, the whole living room was empty, except still the white elephant there. Now, what's the moral of the story? Comes the end of the story, of course. The moral of the story is nobody talks about the white elephant. And nobody asks, how can we get this white elephant out of the room so we can have a conversation? Now, that's a simple story. But isn't that often the case? We know there's a big white elephant in between you and me. Or about between us as a marriage, or in the family, or here, death, grief, big white elephant. And now you can pretend it's not there and look around it, nothing will go. We need to talk about that white elephant. And this is what I just want to share with you. If you see a person who's gone through grief, and it doesn't matter if it's death, job loss, health loss, marriage broke down, personal issues, they want sometimes to talk about. If they don't want to talk about it, I'll let you know. But you at least need to create somehow the safety in which they can speak about it. I mentioned here, encourage or make it safe to cry. Yeah? Crying is very healthy. Crying is an incredibly important gift that God has given us. I might have said it the last time, but in the Bible time when they have a grief situation, they hire weepers. Do you ever think of doing that? A whole group of volunteers, they come and descend on the house and they weep. They howl, actually. You can still see it in Israel today. And when there's a funeral, the people just howl. They're really loud in their grief. And if you look at that, you think, wow, now not all of those people are actually grieving. Those are just hired weepers. Gee, well, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? No, you go to our funerals.
What do you hear on our funerals, usually? Very quiet. Right?
Yeah.
Very, very quiet. Silent. He said, that's good. Well, maybe it's not so good. Because for whom is that silent most embarrassing? For the people that are torn up with grief and they actually would like to sob and they would like to weep, but they don't dare to because everybody sees it. So if you put 50 weepers around them, then you can weep without anybody noticing you're actually weeping. Now that's why these people do this. It's a psychological a safety zone in which they encourage the actual weeper to cry. And then when those tears of grief come out of your eye, and you put them under the microscope, and you analyze them, and you know, you find something incredibly interesting. Research has indicated that the crying, real crying, under grief or stress or pain, releases the harmful chemicals that build up in your brain that makes you depressed. When you take the grief, if you take the tears of joy, women can do that, right? I don't know, I assume say that, but some women, they actually weep when they're joyful. Right? I cannot do it, but I've seen people do it. They're so happy and they cry. Now, if you take those tears and you put them in the microscope, they're entirely chemically different. Isn't that neat? God made a mechanism through our tear duct to shed the very depressant chemicals in our brain. And so people who have had a real cry, they say they feel cleansed. They feel actually better. Now, that's exactly how God designed it. So here in our society, we say, don't weep, don't weep, don't weep. You know, don't cry. Crying is, we men don't cry. We say that to our boys sometimes when we grow up, the boys don't cry. And so when boys don't cry, then big men don't cry either. No, that's not psychologically, it's very wrong. Encourage crying. Very important. Now, initiate therefore the contact by acknowledging what has happened. How do you do that? How do you start a conversation? Now, when you come in a house where a death has taken place, I undoubtedly, 95% of the cases, there's a picture. Well, there you start. Ah, I see you have a picture of your husband here. That's him, right? Yeah. Or your daughter. Wow. She was a really young, beautiful woman. Yeah. What you're doing is you're acknowledging what's real in this living room. There's a picture. There's an empty place. And they're trying to fill up with that picture. So that's your contact point. You need to find a little contact point in this person's life which would be the initiator of the conversation by acknowledging what has happened. Now, there's a loss. Don't ever think that that's painful. We also think that is painful to bring that up. No, that's not painful to bring up. It is painful not to bring it up. It hurts far more if we avoid the grieving person's issue. It's like you don't vindicate. You don't actually give them the feeling that that's really important, what they're grieving about. Yeah. If you don't want to talk about it, it's obviously not important. But I'm thinking about it, night and day. I'm trying to adjust. I'm dealing with it. So I really appreciate it, people here in the congregation, true, that in the week or two after I accepted the call, I didn't want to meet any one of you. I don't know if you noticed, but I went off. I wanted to avoid everybody. I went to the Netherlands 2 weeks later, you remember? It was the worst 2 weeks I've had. Every time I was done with my work, I went back to my motel room and I avoided everybody. I didn't want to talk to anybody. I was grieving. You want to be alone. And yet, I hated to be alone. Now, some of you did very well in this congregation because every time you saw me, you acknowledged what happened. And you say, you know, Pastor, we're really kind of sad. And now it was safe for me to talk. Because you acknowledged what was happening. And so that's what you need to do. And then it is safe to talk. And then I could talk. And I think some of you may remember that once you asked the question, you stood there for 15 minutes because I wanted to talk about it.
And that's exactly what you need to do. Thanks for doing that. Acknowledge what happened. There's a sheep outside I see on the parking lot, so we'll have to make sure that we get Ronald. He's taking off. I'll just let him go for now. We'll catch him later. It's a white sheep. It's not a white elephant, at least. Okay, now D. Remember, they don't need your wise advice, but your listening love. This is an underlying statement. They need your listening, patient love. Grievers share not because they're looking for advice. Sharing is unburdening. Sharing is to offload on someone else what I cannot carry myself. And so, when you come to visit a griever person, he wants to talk, or she wants to talk, if she feels that liberty to talk about it, please remember, they're not looking for your advice. This is where Job's friends went wrong. They listened to Job in chapter 3 and they thought, hey, he needs an answer. What Job needed, he needed 2 more months of listening. Not answers. Not advice. Everything went wrong after that. So, if you say, you know, the person is sharing with you, offer to them, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to help you. But I'm listening. That's okay to say. If you say, but I don't know what to say to him. So I feel so afraid to go and sit there and listen. Because what do I say when they're done talking? Nothing. Just say, yeah, thanks for sharing that. I really don't know what to answer, but I've been listening. That is far better than saying, oh yeah, you should be doing this, or no advice. Don't interpret when you give a phone call to a person. I just wanted to put it in there for a moment. Let's say you give a phone call to the person and says, you know, you might not come around. And he says, no, thanks. I'd rather not. Now, how would you feel? You feel a little offended. Be honest. Just try to offer to go a phone call. Don't feel offended. I tell every griever and every person that goes through sickness and every person that goes through an affliction, be assertive. Don't let people sit on your doorstep when you don't ready for it. I learned it from my wife, Melanie. You know, people would come for an hour and a half to have a visit with her. She says, you know, do me a favor. Make sure in 10 minutes they're gone. So I don't dare to do it. You can't do it. So after 10 minutes, it was my job. She says, you know, thanks for coming, but it's time to go. And some people didn't understand that. And I explained to them later. She says, you know, that was my wife's request. She can't handle more than that. So make it short. Make your visit short. And I tell every griever, be assertive. If you don't feel like talking, be polite, but say, no, please, not right now. I'd appreciate it if you try again a day later. Yeah, so don't be offended, please. Because they need their space, and yet do not interpret, no thanks, I need some space, as I never want to see you again. Don't interpret as long term. Maybe they mean this. No, not today, but I'm going to test you to see if you're really genuine if you call back tomorrow. Yeah? Because remember, it's a safety thing. If they're going to share with you something on the inside, they feel insecure. And so a person wants to know you are really genuine. So maybe they're just testing. And of course, sometimes they're just completely in the lack of energy and exhausted. So maybe they don't feel like it. But grieving people like to talk about what talks within their heart, within circles all day long. It's like a CD going back and forth and back and forth. And that can sometimes go on for months. Yeah? When grieving people share, they share chaotic. That means they don't have all things in order. They don't always have things in the right perspective either. That's okay. This is even worse for women than for men. And those of us who live with women in marriage will know that. When women share their stories, they go all over the show. There is no rhyme or reason sometimes.
And we men say, no, 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 that didn't happen first. This happened for them. That isn't important for women. When they share as they share the sorting out. They don't ask you to sort out. We men just have to sit there and be all attention. That's really hard, very hard. But they sort out as they talk. And I've learned that over the last decades that my wife doesn't really need my advice. If she needs that, she asks for it. But what she needs is my ear. And more than my ear. Yeah? Grievers have a little bit of saying. Not quite the same, but as a griever tells his story, the sorting out, and they're not necessarily putting it all in the right order. It's as they share that they gain a deeper understanding of their own needs, and they're adjusting slowly out. Now, what happens if I don't have anything to say? Don't worry about mutual silences in your visits with grieving people. Go to eat. Job's friends help him the most when their mouth remains shut. And I've already mentioned that. I have an uncle. Well, he passed away now. But he had a tremendous difficult life with one of his sons committing suicide. He said, I had so many people coming to my house in those days after that. And I said, none of those people I remember, but I remember one boy, black boy, from South America. He was a friend of my son, he said. And he came in, and he came and sat next to me on the couch. Uncle Hype. He said nothing. He sat there, put his arm on my shoulder, and he started to cry. Just cry with him. And he said, we sat there for about 15 minutes on that couch. He said nothing except he cried a little bit and sighed, and he says, I love you, Omar. Goodbye. He walked up. My uncle said that boy helped him more than everybody else, than anybody else. He was there with him, shared the pain, didn't necessarily say anything, yet you could feel in his heart he was grieving with him. I just thought that is so beautiful. That's probably what Job's friends did those first 7 days. I'm sure when they looked at Job, they couldn't even recognize the man. He had been so changed. They lifted up their eyes and they knew him not. That was such a change in his life circumstances and in his bodily presentation that they sat there with him. They wept. Locust, they rent their clothes. They sprinkled dust upon their heads and they just empathized with him. Those 7 days. And please, I know many people say, I don't dare to go to visit them because I don't know what to say. Don't need to say anything. Your presence, especially in those early weeks or months, is so important, but not your words. Yeah, your words, they'll never even remember anyway. Our words won't change anything of the circumstances. Remember that? Our words will not change anything of our circumstances. Our words are just loud noises, but our shared silence, and sometimes if you can really grieve with them, so much more meaningful. Listening doesn't mean I need to say something back when they stop talking. The purpose of your talk is to invite talk. So if you don't know what to say at the end, then you say simply that. I really don't know what to say. But thank you, George. I have been listening. And I understand this is pretty hard. And then may I just jump for a moment to G? Yeah? Help grievers to speak by using active listening techniques. Now, you're going to have to try this on each other if you can. Try it on your kids. Try it on your spouse. Try it on anybody you know. Go try it tomorrow. You'll see amazing, amazing things happening. Now, what do I mean with reflective listening techniques, active listening techniques? Now, note what I say in number one. Reflective listening restates what the person that's talking to you said. So let's say that the person says to you, I had a really terrible day today. What are you going to say back? Oh, well, it wasn't so bad. The weather was pretty good, wasn't it? Now, if you say back that kind of a statement, you immediately close the door on all conversation. Because you have not validated the person who's speaking to you. You're not even listening. What is effective listening is this. When the person says, I've had a terrible bad day today. Okay. So, your day was not very good, was it? What I just do, I restated what I heard in different words. And I fed it back to that person. That person is picking up my response. Says, hey, he was listening. And now he's going to give you more information. Yeah, that was a really terrible day. Because, and that comes a whole long story. Now, as you listen to the whole long story, you better listen because you are supposed to summarize that story from him and give it back to him. Not adding your values to it, not adding your evaluations to it, not adding your judgment to it, no. Your task is to listen. So now you're feeding it back to him again. And what's happening in the meantime? That person is really getting the feeling you are listening. And he's getting engaged with you and beginning to share. Now, this is what a griever needs, right? A griever needs to share. And a griever needs someone to listen to him. So reflective listening is very important. It's actually very difficult. Why is it very difficult? Because we're having a terrible hard time listening. Don't you? To concentrate someone who is telling you a story with all your attention is not one of my skills, I'll be honest. But that's very important, and a person that you are speaking to can sense it when you're not really listening. But when he hears that you restate what you are listening to in your own words back to him, he gets the feeling, hey, this fellow is really listening. I'm going to talk on and on. So that's an active listening technique. Now I gave away my big skill, didn't I? But that is a really important skill. With kids, with adults, with grievers, with non-grievers, really in all kinds of situations. And what happens too, this is very important, sometimes you may reflect something of his conversation that's not exactly the right reflection. And they say this, no, that's not what I meant. I meant this. And you get more explanation. That's active listening. And I really encourage you, if you go to a person in a crisis, this person who is in the crisis needs to grow towards growing, and he is doing that as you are listening to him. And deep down, a lot of times they know their own solutions already. They don't always want to go that way yet, but they do. I give you 5 reasons why listening is so difficult. I am on G2. 1, because we think we need to say something. They've done research on people. How many of you having a difficult time forgetting the name of the person you talk to for the first time? Yeah, we all do. Not all do, but many of us do. Right? Many of us do having a difficult time remembering the name. If you say you meet somebody for the first time and say, hey, my name is Peter. Oh, easy name, Peter. Why is that? Why do we forget that name? Do you know that? Because you're worried about what you need to say next after he stops talking. And because you're worried about it, you're not listening to him. And it doesn't register. And then you're really embarrassed because 2 minutes later you think, well, what's this guy's name again? And you're so embarrassed you don't even dare to ask him anymore. What was your name again? Because it means you weren't listening back then. He told you his name. And we're not that forgetful that after 2 minutes we don't remember someone's name. So it is often we think we need to say something. That's why listening is so difficult. The second thing of difficult is listening is because we want to tell our own story. We're not really out there to listen. We were out there to tell our own story. No, we're not out there. When you go to a grieving person to tell your own story, unless your own story will help the person as he struggles. And third reason is listening to someone can be a bit frightening because you're going to share his or her pain. And that may not be always so easy. Now I'll go back to F. Listen without judging who or what you hear. Grievous say many wrong things. That's why I read Job 3 tonight. Job 3 is a chapter full of things that are not necessarily right to say. Yeah, Job is completely filled with pain and grief and confusion and, yeah, incredible. And so what comes out of his mouth there is not really right. We know that. You cannot say these things, but he does say them. So when you talk to a person who really goes through grief, he says many things wrong. There's probably a lot more things he could say wrong that he doesn't say yet. That does not mean you need to agree or approve with everything that they say, but you need to recognize that the pain can be so real that they just want to get it out. And the worst thing then for us to do, friends, is to go against what they said wrong. I made mistakes in this area over the years of my pastoral ministry. I will be acknowledging that. I have sometimes made mistakes by not listening long enough and by too quickly jumping in to speak against what I might hear or perceive to hear. And then, yeah, you kind of miss an opportunity. So, obviously, Job's words here need correction. You cannot leave that. But maybe after 6 months, you could begin to talk with Job about these things. When he's beginning to settle down, or when maybe surrendering comes, or when the grace of God indeed helps him to grow, you might have to revisit a chapter like this in Job's life and say, yeah, Job, these things, is that really right to say? So, judge not, certainly not, a person that goes through grief. The acceptance of their feelings validates the reality of their struggles, I write, and builds trust. Yeah. Once you have validated yourself as a friend who doesn't judge, time will come that you may become a biblical counselor to encourage or to redirect and to begin to mold that person's thinking slowly, little by little, away from a chapter 3 like this. That may happen. It may take time. Now, 8. Share stories and memories of the deceased and suffering. Very meaningful. Make the memories worth remembering. People have sent letters to me telling me stories about my wife, sending me pictures that they took, that they had in their box, that I hadn't seen. Very nice to do that with people who have lost someone. So don't ever think that's painful. That is so soothing, even though it causes pain. There's obviously a sweetness to that. Now, that's true in the case of my grief, where someone who really dear to me has died. There's other grief where pictures are not appropriate. Yeah, think of the divorce grief. Think of the grief I guess that's the worst one. Criminal behavior that has taken place in a family. Maybe a child has a real difficult time with his father's behavior and so on. So maybe you have to be very careful that you don't bring in memories that may make the pain more acute. But I'm talking here about the grief of loved ones. This, I guess, in my own personal life, my second wife, of course, has a lot more stories about my first wife than I ever had, which is kind of unique. Michelle lived for many years with Melanie that I did not live with her. So my kids heard stories and stories about Melanie, their mother, that I could never share with them. And that was very meaningful to them, these memories that they have learned in this way about their own mother, who couldn't tell these kind of stories to her own children anymore. Bury all cliches. Now, what are cliches? Here's a couple of them. You want to make sure that you never say that. I know exactly how you feel. Do you? Well, we say it sometimes, right? I heard this one yet even last week. A parent who had a couple who had lost a child. And some meaningful adult spoke to their older children and said, "You have to be now as strong as you can be for your parents, okay, kids? Now be as strong as you can be for your parents, okay?" And we're talking about 11-year-olds and 9-year-olds. Now that's not nice. It's not nice to say to a 9-year-old, be as strong as possible. They're not an adult, they're a kid. So that's a cliche in which we think we're going to help this family. You know, don't put more burdens on this kid than he has already. He is only a child. Or if you say, you know what, be as strong as you can be now, may say to a person, "I'm not allowed to grieve then. I have to put up a front." So that's a cliche that really is not helpful. How about this one? You should count your blessings. Is that bad to say that? It's not bad at all to say that, but maybe not on a moment when an acute crisis has taken place. You know, when you're like this, go ahead and count your blessings. I don't see any blessings at this moment. So that can actually fall really wrong in somebody's mind. Or this one, it's God's will, and He will not give you more than you can handle. I didn't feel that way. I did not feel that way at all, that God was giving me not more than I could handle. So, yes, true, but maybe now in that right moment. That's a nice cliche, but we should be careful not to throw that too quick. God's ways are holy. I mean, a man said to me when I was standing in the funeral home, shaking hands. Stand next to the casket of my wife. "Yeah, God's ways are holy and righteous, aren't they, brother?" Is that true? Of course it's true. But was that really a nice thing to say at a moment like that? No, I don't judge the man for he probably had no clue what he was saying. And he didn't mean it wrong. But I certainly felt wrong. Because everything in me is very painful. So be careful. Those are what I mean with cliches. Then please don't say anything if you don't know what to say. Say, "I'm really sorrowful for you. I'm trying to remember that you're having a hard time." But don't say some things that you don't know about yourself. Realize each person is unique. Yeah, you have never been in their shoes because each person is unique. And I've learned that too. I've learned that my grief is not like anybody else's grief. I was in a completely different situation than some other people have gone through who have lost their spouse or their child. I don't have been in their shoes, and you have not been in their shoes. So maybe you have yourself gone through a grief situation, then you'll understand that the person who also goes through it is not like you. Yeah, maybe your mom handled the loss of a child better than your friend handles the loss of a child. You say, "Yeah, but my mom did this and said that." So now you are putting your mom into the shoes of your friend. Don't do that. Acknowledge that a person's personality, family circumstances, spiritual relationship with God, spiritual maturity, character issues, all are things which influences how you deal with grief. So avoid any statement that tends to minimize or invalidate grief, even if they may be truths. For example, "You're still young. You'll hopefully get more children." That is not at all validating the grief I am going through right now. It's like, "Oh, no big deal. Something else will come better. Or someday you'll meet somebody else to accompany you." That may be true, and hopefully that will be true. But that's not what I want to hear now. I want to be known that I am dealing with an issue that is painful. Or this one. "So-and-so not only lost their daughter, but they lost their husband and son in one day." I'm taking these quotes out of real life, okay? These are quotes I read as well. So you say that to someone who's lost his daughter. That's really helpful. Or, "It's better so, otherwise it would have been a long way of suffering." Yeah? Those are statements that invalidate the grief that is taking place. Okay, don't forget children. Children are poor talkers, but they love a good game. So when you go visit a group, a family, where there has been grief, maybe you should say, hey kids, shall we play some soccer outside? Yeah, you don't do it with kids and that, why not? See, the parents don't feel like that. But the kids need sometimes a little energy off. So you play a little bit soccer with them, and then you sit down on the soccer field and have a talk. I tell you, you're going to have a good talk then. Because now you've been on their level. So kids are kids, and they deal with grief and situations like that in a kid's way. If the kids are really small, pictures are great. I've just been talking to Andy and Sonia, who have been who have lost a little child. This is a couple in Kalamazoo that I know well. They've gone to a little bit of grief counseling, and those grief counselors have done a lot with pictures. Kids, of course, express their grief story in pictures, and that can be very helpful. Sometimes kids do not know what they feel like. So what I've done effectively with my kids sometimes, I took six cards and I put six faces on there. Sad, mad, happy, scared or fearful, lonely or confused. Yeah? And so in the weeks afterwards, when we had our times to sit down together, I would put all six on the table and I'd say, now, Jonathan, when you're thinking about Mama, which face are you going to pick today? Yeah, you pick mad. Okay, so you're mad today. So why are you mad? See, if I would have asked him, how do you feel? I don't know. That's how kids are, they don't know. But you give them a choice, they know exactly what they feel like. So this is a very helpful way with children, not even only in grief situations, but in all kinds of situations. You need to give them a little help sometimes to know what they actually feel like. And then you have to talk with them. L, sympathy is also doing things. Yeah, offer specific and practical help in early stages. Grievers usually don't have the energy. They feel embarrassed to ask. They feel uncomfortable in the role of the needy. And so you need to take the initiative. Yeah, can I perhaps do some shopping for you? You know what? Can I... I see that the lawn needs some mowing. You mind me doing that for mowing tomorrow for you? Yeah, practical. Just practical things you see. Don't ask, can I do something for you? Because that's too vague. You see what needs to happen. So, can I do that for you this week? So in the early stages, very good to help these people with practical things. But that, of course, shouldn't go all the time. Look at what I say in N. Be supportive and watch for over-dependence. Mourners need to get back to making their own decisions and handling their own stuff as quick as possible. That's healthy. And so it's only in this first period, maybe the first weeks, that you really are going out to try to help them to get the life in order again. But be very careful that you do not make you an ongoing crutch. Mark birthdays, anniversaries, and special dates. You're going to forget. But they don't. I get on Melanie's death anniversary, I get still emails from some people that remember that's the day. And I so appreciate that. This is not more than, what is it, about 17 years ago, 16 years ago. Man, time flies. And they still sent me an email on that day. Yeah, I am probably one of the only kids that called my mom later this month when my dad died, November 21. I don't take it ill for my brothers that they forget. But I know that's the day that Mom is mourning all over again. Even though it's 33 years ago. That's a special day in her life. Matter of fact, this week is a special week because that's the week you went into the hospital. So I will give her a call. Yeah, just a little thing, but it's very important. And it gives a little bit of time to chat, perhaps, and to talk about it. Because remember, grief is never over, it erupts less often. Often when we think the griever is ready to pick up the pieces, the griever may say, no, I'm just actually beginning to deal with it right now and I'm falling apart. And that can be months in the journey that all of a sudden they feel like they've had it, they can't make it, they are struggling. And often the first months it's a shock phase, and then really the reality is becoming so real they need some help. But it is never quite over. It just comes out a little less. I told you before, I suppose. See, now that I know that, I know when couples remarry that have lost a loved one, I get in touch with them prior to their marriage, because I know the honeymoon is a depressing week. It's not an exciting week for the remarriage. It's not. I felt real depressed on my honeymoon with Michelle. And Michelle got all confused. Oh, man, are you grinning? Something like that. So, I didn't realize. Then when Melanie was born, and my first one with Michelle, I had a really hard time for a couple of days. All the grief comes back. When my oldest daughter got married here three years ago, I walked her down the aisle. But I walked with somebody else down the aisle too, who wasn't there. I didn't expect that. Yeah. But that's grief. It's there. It's part of you. And it comes out even many, many years later. So remember that. The Moroccan people say, may God give you the patience to endure. And that is exactly what we need. It is always going to be with us. I'd like you to look at O, suggest anyone to write in a journal. I don't know how many journal writers there are here in our midst tonight. But I suggest anyone to write in a journal, actually. Writing and journaling is an excellent and often untapped means of separating the multitudes of your thoughts within you. Yeah, that's my own method as well. When I have all these thoughts going through my head day and night, it can be really, really depressing. And when I feel I'm getting there, I know it's time for me to start journaling again. And once I start journaling, things seem to disappear. Because I now begin to, as it were, analyze what are all the issues I'm dealing with. Now, that's the journaling part. So please help the griever to journal. Tell them to get a notebook and begin to write. Write out what they're thinking. Write out their conflicts. Write out their feelings. Write out their prayers. Because that's often what it becomes. And it gives a sense of relief. I find it all the time when people are doing this. It gives them a real sense of relief of sorting out their thoughts on paper. And they say, oh, it didn't quite look as bad as I thought it was. For example, one of my big habits is I take a piece of paper and I divide it in half like this. And I write down here, what are all the things that are troubling me? Usually it's longer list than this. Write them all here. And then on this side, I write down, what can I do about it? What can I do about number one? Write it down. What can I do about number two? Write it down. Number three, I can do nothing about that. That's unchangeable. Number four, write it down and then do it. Now what happens then to all these problems? Some of them actually disappear. And you feel much lighter. Now the griever needs to do that because the griever feels like he's overburdened with all the waves of emotions. And some of these emotions can be taken care of by doing the thing that is right to do, but they're not doing it because there's too much going on. Yeah? So that's helpful not only in a grieving situation. Maybe you're feeling depressed sometimes or overwhelmed. Okay? Take a journal. Write. Allow the griever privacy. Don't invade their space if not desired. I don't think I have to say more on that. But they like to stand alone sometimes, and actually they don't like to be alone. That's the strange thing about it. They like to retreat, and yet they don't want to be forgotten. And so, if you see a grieving child, for example, standing alone, yeah, he maybe wants a little time alone. But you may invite him and say, "Yo, if you're ready to come and share some time with me, I'll wait." Don't pressure people. Because, you know, sometimes grief is a reaction you never count on. I lost my train of thought here now for a moment. Oh yeah, the privacy. Sometimes a smell will set off a grief reaction in me. Strange, isn't it? There's a certain smell I would associate with my wife, and instantly I want a little privacy. Dealing with that. Sometimes it was a sound that reminded me. While I was driving or walking or something, all of a sudden is a trigger. See, and then child has that too. A child suddenly realizes, oh, I don't see Opa anymore in this situation, or Grandma no more in that situation. And all of a sudden he or she gets his flashback and wants a little privacy. And maybe stand there for 10, 15 minutes by himself by the fence if it's in the school situation trying to deal with this. Now, as a teacher or as fellow students, we like to say, hey, you come on, join with us. Maybe they just need a little bit of time, and then you need to give them that. With children, Q is very important. Maintain routine with clear and normal expectations. Kids are, you know, back to this again. Children, particularly in the crisis situation, on the tip of this upside down triangle. Now, the more routines you remove out of his or her life, the more insecure he or she becomes. So we might say, well, you know, we're going to take those kids away for the weekend into our own home. Now, it's a lovely offer. It's very genuine and very nice, but maybe not the best. Because when you are taking these kids out of the situation like that, you're actually creating more insecurity because you're taking away all the normal routines and environment. You see, that's sometimes how it can backfire. So if they're expecting to do their homework, yes, they're expecting to do their homework. They're expecting to take care of their own problems. Yes, they are. Maintain the routines as much as possible. And lastly, and that's only last, when you find someone is not doing well. Yeah, there comes a self-neglect. The people begin to harm themselves by not eating or overeating. A hyperactive behavior. A continued self-condemnation. Serious sleep problems. Denial. Indulgent behavior like drinking or eating or buying things. Or risk-taking behavior. If you see that in a person, you know this person is not coping well. Then he or she needs professional help. But if you say to them, you need help, they're not going to get it. If you say, you know what, we've been working together with this, and I'm really at the end of how much I can help you. But I have looked around in the yellow pages, and I have found so-and-so. Or I have talked, and I have found this counselor. It really would be good. Shall we go make a phone call to him or her to make an appointment? See, you're actually helping now the person to actually find the help. Because that's what they need, to get over that edge. Because the one who is losing doesn't have that initiative anymore. And yes, there are cases where we need to have professional help. Yeah? Now, I stop now with my last statement is the stump in the tree in the back garden. That's actually my own favorite picture of grief and loss. Picture your backyard and you have this massive, beautiful oak tree. It is taking up the whole backyard. It is an absolute gem of a tree. Now that's life like this, right? Normal, everything is going well. All of a sudden there comes the issue, whatever it is, death, sickness. And all of a sudden, like this, or you can say someone takes a big chainsaw and she cuts that whole big oak tree in the backyard. It's gone. So now you look out the window, what do you see? Every time you look out the window, you see a tree stump and no tree. Morning and at night, you look out that window, there's that big old tree stump, and you can't get the tree stump out. It's just too big. And some of you recognize that. And you're going to have that tree stump the rest of your life in that backyard. But as life goes on, something can happen. You are starting to make a garden around the tree stump. And if you're a clever gardener, you are actually going to use the tree stump eventually in your new garden as an aspect of your garden. Now that's what my life looks like now. I still have my big tree stump in my life. Yeah? The picture standing right next to my computer screen of my first bite. It's always there. Because it lives basically in your heart. But there's a tree stump which at this moment is completely part of a new garden. It's the garden of my marriage and my family life. It's wherever. It's there. It's part of it. I don't sit there every time looking at that tree stump anymore. It's just a beautiful part of my life. It's become a part of the new backyard. But it's always going to be there. That makes sense? Now, once it becomes that way, I think you have learned to cope with the grief situation. And that issue is always there. Once in a while, you focus on that deer, that tree stump, and the grief is there, the feelings are there, but the landscape around it changes and grows. What doesn't change is the tree stump. That's always going to be there. Now, I enclose a poem that is a wonderful poem for you to have handy. I need to talk about my loss. I may often need to tell you what happened or to ask you why it happened. Each time I discuss my loss, I'm helping myself face the reality of the death of my loved one. I need to know that you care about me. I need to feel your touch, your hugs. I need you just to be with me. And I need to be with you. I need to know you believe in me and in my ability to get through my grief in my own way and in my own time. Please don't judge me now or think that I'm behaving strangely. Remember, I'm grieving. I may even be in shock. I may feel afraid. I may feel deep rage. I may even feel guilty. But above all, I hurt. I'm experiencing a pain unlike any I have ever felt before. Don't worry if you think I'm getting better and then I suddenly seem to slip backward. Grief makes me behave this way at times. And please don't tell me to get on with my life. I'm probably already saying this to myself. What I need most is time to grieve and recover at my pace. Most of all, thank you for being my friend. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your caring. Thank you for your helping, for your understanding. Thank you for praying with me. And remember, in the days or years ahead, after your loss, when you need me, as I have needed you, I'll understand. And then I will come and be with you. And the other side, as one on listening, when I ask you to listen to me and you start giving advice, you have not done what I asked. When I ask you to listen and you begin to tell me why I shouldn't feel that way, you are trampling on my feelings. When I ask you to listen to me and you feel you have something to solve my problems, you failed me. Strange as it may seem. Listen. All I ask is that you listen. Not talk or do. Just hear me. Advice is cheap. A few dollars will get you both Dorothy Dix and Dr. Spock in the same newspaper. And I can do for myself. I'm not helpless. Maybe discouraged and faltering, but not helpless. When you do something for me that I can and need to do for myself, you contribute to my fear and weakness. But when you accept as a simple fact that I do feel what I feel, no matter how irrational, then I quit trying to convince you, and you can get about the business of understanding what's behind this irrational feeling. And when that's clear, the answers are obvious and I don't really need advice. So please listen and just hear me. And if you want to talk, wait a minute for your turn and I'll listen to you. Isn't that neat? Isn't that hard? Harry, you know. You're listening on Lifeline. Nothing is all you do is listen, right? And sometimes, of course, you can give a little feedback. But most of the time, as you listen, you actually are giving those people a tremendous feedback. Right? Anything to add to that, Harry? You have listened to this lecture. Yeah.
Sometimes people ask, why has all this happened? And indeed, I don't know why. But if they are people that read the Bible, I encourage them to read Job.
Yeah.
Because he didn't know why it happened either.
Yeah. And, you know, you're making a point that reminds me of something I needed to say. Of course, what I've not done at this and this in these two lectures is to give any theological framework. I mean, I have done a very practical counseling directed topic. I mean, there's more spiritual and more biblical truths that can be added to this, which I didn't do that in this case. And that is where, you know, the pastoral work or your own pointing out passages of the scripture, of course, can be tremendous help. But that's a different story. I just wanted to get really practical in these lectures to give you some nuts and bolts about what it is to grieve and how you could help the griever. So thank you so much. If there are any questions, I gladly take them now. Shall we then sing one more song together? If anyone has a suggested psalter that fits in with the theme tonight, if not, I can find you one. At least I'm looking for it. I said I was going to find it. Maybe we'll do that one together. Verse 1, 2, and 3 of 383. All that I am, I owe to thee. I found sometimes comfort in that song. Sometimes I found it very difficult to sing, especially the second verse. But in the end, the third, it is so true. God's thoughts are manifold and more precious unto me than gold, especially when we think about providence. So let's do the first three of 383. Let us together close the evening. Faithful Lord, also this psalter has not been a psalter that has grown without a deep experience of trials and afflictions that David went through in his life. And therefore the psalms that we have, Lord, we may thank thee for it, how valuable they are, and teach us all
the manifoldness of thy thoughts and the depth of it. Lord, we confess that ways that thou goes with us and with people is so different than what we think we need or what would be good for us. But teach us to trust thee, that before our days began, our life has been ordered in its perfect plan by thee. O gracious God, help us to be then also, as we go forth again with these additional thoughts and skills that we have looked at this evening, that we may be an effective helper. May establish a relationship of listening, of trust, and that so also we may eventually become someone to pass on the rich truths of thy word as the only comfort in life and death. So Lord, guide us now as we go home again. Bring us safety through the night and bless our sleep and strengthen our bodies. We ask it all in Jesus' name. Amen.